From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a debate twist, Romney takes it with 32 days until the presidential election. There's a new tone. Unemployment's down to 7.8%, thank heavens. And a world away, Syria and Turkey trade artillery fire. Yesterday at a rally in Fisherville, Virginia, Mitt Romney looked to seize the momentum of his strong debate showing.
He and I stand for something very different. I'm going to help the American people get good jobs and a bright future.
President Obama fired up after the debate, said who was that moderate-sounding guy?
Governor Romney may dance around his positions, but if you want to be president, you owe the American people the truth.
And Syria and NATO ally Turkey trade artillery fire. Here's the chaos in a Turkish border town. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Has one debate changed this race? Did it change your mind? Was it Etch-a-Sketch? Real deal? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington is Brian Monroe, editor of CNNPolitics.com. Brian, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom, good to be with you.
Great to have you. And from Denver, Molly Ball, staff writer covering all things politics for The Atlantic. She was at Wednesday night's presidential debate. Molly, great to have you back as well.
Hi, Tom, good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Brian, and Molly.
Are you brushing up your debating skills, Jack? Going to change your life?
Yes, I've got an empty chair right beside me.
All right. Okay, what has happened to this race? Brian, do we have a new race? Do we have a wrinkle in the old race? What's going on?
Well, just when it looked like Barack Obama had created some distance between he and Romney, particularly in the battleground states, then Wednesday happens. And now it's I wouldn't say a whole new ball game, but certainly makes it much more interesting. You know, the one thing that's interesting is as tough as Wednesday night was on the president, and he was not his best showing at all. You know, we have sort of the history looking back saying that debates rarely move the needle far enough to flip the script on a presidential race. It may make it closer, but over, you know, since they've been having these presidential debates in this forum, only twice has it really changed the outcome. Most of the time, it usually ends up being what it was before the
debates don't move the needle. But Molly Ball, a lot of Democrats you were talking to were as sort of down in the dumps and gnashing of teeth as Republicans were just a week ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of a funny reversal. I went to see President Obama speak before he left town here in Denver, and the Democrats in that crowd were evincing the same sort of symptoms of jitteriness that I've been seeing at Republicans at Mitt Romney's events for several weeks, the sort of anger and frustration and denial and blaming the media and not being sure who to blame and starting to freak out. I think Brian is very right that we shouldn't overstate the potential importance of this. It's very unlikely that we're going to write the history of this election and look back and say this is the moment that the curve on the polls just changed direction and nothing was ever the same. But what I think happened was those polls were starting to gel in a way that made Republicans really uncomfortable because people were starting to close their minds to Romney. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of those persuadable voters or voters in the middle starting to rule him out. And people were seeing his support softening and Obama's support hardening, especially in those swing states. Mm. Now what I think people are going to see is that voters are giving him another look. They're open to Romney. They're going to listen to him. They're going to give him a chance. So he's got an opportunity here. He doesn't have an advantage necessarily, but he's got an opportunity that he can seize if he plays it right.
Boy, it was incredible the next morning, however kind of tired the president may have looked on the stage that night. That's one word you could use for it. The next morning he was all fired up. And here's a little tape where he's saying, kind of pay no attention to that guy who was on the stage. Maybe that wasn't Mitt Romney.
When I got onto the stage, I met this very spirited fellow who claimed to be Mitt Romney. But it couldn't have been Mitt Romney, because the real Mitt Romney has been running around the country for the last year, promising $5 trillion in tax cuts that favor the wealthy. The fellow on stage last night said he didn't know anything about that.
Okay. Jack Beatty, was the president thrown off by meeting a very spirited fellow on the stage or something else?
Well, you know, Al Gore has a hypothesis about what happened. It was the mile high air. Obama got off the plane at 2 o'clock, and he just had, he wasn't acclimated to climbing into the air, so it was the rear air.
Yeah, well,
he did seem to be nonplussed. He had clearly had some sort of game plan to appeal to independent voters by, you know, not being too aggressive. And there's some evidence from a Reuters poll that he actually helped himself among independents while really dispiriting Democrats and, of course, buoying Republicans. So it's and as for his point there, you know, who's the real Mitt Romney? Here we have Romney, February 22nd this year. We're going to cut taxes on everyone across the country by 20%, including the top 1%. And here he is this week. I will not reduce taxes paid by high-income Americans. So who's the real Mitt Romney? That question, again, I think is to the fore.
Well, I mean, Molly, in fairness, the president has, for a long time, been characterizing this as $5 trillion in tax cuts by Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney said the other night, no, that's an interpretation of what I'm going to do, and I don't agree with it. But the president's taken it on as kind of gospel here. Now, everybody would have a 20% tax cut under the Romney plan, but then he's saying there would be a bunch of deductions that go away. That's what he has refused to specify. So nobody knows exactly what those would be, exactly who they would hit. But he keeps making the claim between that and growth, you're not going to have increase in the deficit. And, you know, he just doesn't take Obama's analysis of his numbers.
That's right. But I think what frustrated people was that Obama wasn't able to sort of point out that distinction or explain to people how Mitt Romney was threading the needle, to be generous, about these two potentially contradictory claims that he is claiming at the same time. You know, I talked to his people about this after the debate. Are you, you know, he just said he's not going to cut taxes on the wealthy, but don't you, have you abandoned this 20% across the board tax cut? And they said, no, that's still the plan. But because everybody would get a tax cut, it wouldn't reduce the share of taxes paid by the wealthy. And in addition, the wealthy would potentially make up some of that, but with having these deductions and exemptions, which we're not going to tell you what they are, taken away. So, but you didn't see Obama, you know, being quick on his feet enough to sort of make that case. It was only the next morning that he, I guess, looked at the tape and was able to come up with a comeback. And it's always better, of course, to have that comeback in the moment than the next day.
When you've got the 67 million sets of eyeballs trained on the debate, the Republicans delighted with this outcome and ready to jump in and really go after the president. Johnson Nunu, former New Hampshire governor, Romney surrogates, been very tough on the president. Here he was. Listen carefully to the words he uses to describe the president after the debate.
What people saw last night, I think, was a president that revealed his incompetence, how lazy and detached he is, and how he has absolutely no idea how serious the economic problems of the country are and how he has failed to even begin to address them.
You had better believe the Obama White House is happy to see these 7.8% unemployment numbers today. That is the lowest since January of 2009, since President Obama took office. They couldn't come at a better time for the president. Of course, you could do better than 7.9, but it sounds better than 8.1. Paul Ryan was ready to really lay the accolades on his running mate, Mitt Romney. Here he was yesterday in Fisherville, Virginia.
America got to see the man I know, a leader, a decisive man, an optimistic man, a man with a plan to get people back to work and to protect our freedoms.
Vice presidential running mate Paul Ryan. All right, Brian Monroe, here was Mitt Romney back in the GOP primaries, severely conservative, he said, and he was ready to out-conservative anybody, then very moderate in tone and language on that stage in Denver this week. So is this the real Mitt Romney, did we just see the Etch-a-Sketch moment? What about the president's charge that, you know, who was that guy last night? Did we see a real change in what he's offering the country, Brian, or not?
Well, you know, when Governor Romney said back then that he was severely conservative, that didn't convince a whole bunch of folks. Most people understand him as relatively moderate. That's how he governed in Massachusetts, and that's what his history led up until he started running for president again. And oddly enough, President Obama is also pretty moderate and pragmatic. They're not as far to the extreme as they paint each other to be. But, you know, it's interesting when President Obama yesterday said, you know, who was that on the stage? Where was mm-hmm. the real Mitt Romney? Mm-hmm. He almost could flip that around and said, where was the real Barack Obama? you know, he it was fascinating to watch. We have a brand new studio here at CNN. Ooh. And we're sitting in the control room watching the president, and we had this interesting thing. We put up a split screen almost from the get-go, and some of the other networks came after us, but to watch how both candidates' body language was. And if you looked at President Obama, he was looking down an awful lot, almost like he was biting his tongue. You know, he's
come
across.
Like at his notes or at, I'm not sure.
Or something, but you know, with that, it looked like he was just annoyed for being there. It's like, I'm the president of the United States. Why do I got to be here dealing with this situation right now?
And yeah, but the other guy could be president just a few months from now.
Romney showed up ready to play, ready to fight, ready to rumble. And it's almost like, you know, President Obama with his background, people say he's Chicago tough. Well, actually, I think on Wednesday he looked like Hawaii laid back. You know, he's used to living life on the beach.
A little Hawaii,
exactly.
It difficult? I mean, Molly, you were out there. Is it difficult for the president of the United States to figure out how to compose his face in response to a challenger?
Yeah, it may be especially difficult for Obama, whose personality I think does see these types of sort of gladiatorial political combats as relatively trivial and unserious. And you see him trying to give policy lectures instead of sort of scoring points in these kinds of forums, when that's probably more what he needed to do.
You know, I get that, but Jack, it still bugs me. I mean, democracy comes with hurly-burly. You know, if you can't take the heat, and he's taken a lot of heat, so why not now when the chips are really down?
It was the most puzzling moment of the whole campaign, if not of his presidency.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. A debate jolt. The race heats up for the White House. Turkey-Syria trade artillery fire. We've got those airliner seats on the move. And unemployment down for the first time, farthest down in a long time, 7.9%, the lowest since President Obama took office. Good news right there, we hope, for those without jobs. Molly Ball is here, joins us from Denver. She was out there for the debates, covering politics for The Atlantic. Brian Monroe is here from CNNPolitics.com. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Let's go right to Nashville, Tennessee. Mark's calling. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I watched the debate. I'm a Democrat, and I thought that Obama kind of phoned in his appearance there. I was actually hoping that there would be a tag team event where he could maybe tag Bill Clinton and get some energy.
Doesn't work that way, does it?
No, apparently not.
So what do you think? I mean, here we are. It's October, 32 days left. Is this a calamity for the president? Is it a recoverable margin if he lost something Wednesday night?
Well, I think it's recoverable. I think, based on what I thought the convention, Biden will do a formidable job at Center College in Danville, Kentucky. I'm getting a plug-in for Center because it's my alma mater.
But, right.
I think he'll do a good job, and I think the president has 2 weeks to get his message together and get ready for the next debate.
So there's a Democrat saying, didn't go so well, but you're still hanging in there with some optimism. Here was a Michigan Governor Obama surrogate, Jennifer Granholm, on Current TV after the Denver debates.
We're going to come back, and you're going to see a different president. You're going to see a much more pugilistic president, I think, in his second debate. You've also got Joe Biden coming up with Paul Ryan. That's going to be a fascinating debate. Democrats, progressives, don't be worried.
Don't be worried. But Molly Ball has been talking with him. She knows a lot are. Molly, what about Joe Biden and Paul Ryan coming up in Kentucky? That will be the next debate next week. What do you see coming there?
That is going to be the most fascinating contrast of styles, I think, since we've seen probably since the last vice presidential debate between Joe Biden and Sarah Palin. This is going to be a real a different contrast. But you've got, you know, Paul Ryan, who's known for this sort of cool analytical numbers. He's doing the PowerPoint on the campaign trail now. He's Mr. Wonk with the sort of ill-fitting suits and the head in the spreadsheet. And then you have Joe Biden, who is exactly the opposite. He's Mr. Emotional. We see him out on the campaign trail hugging, you know, bikers and kissing grandmas and and babies alike, and wears his heart on his sleeve. And so I have to imagine both camps are really preparing for this. Biden has to avoid looking like he doesn't know his stuff. He's been really caricatured as sort of this goofball.
Well, he's been frank about that. He said, "I just don't want to make any mistakes."
Right. Well, possibly some expectations lowering there as well. But for Ryan, he's quite young and he needs to avoid looking like the sort of hot-headed whippersnapper, right? who's challenging authority in a way that potentially could come off as glib if he doesn't have his tone right.
If he's not careful, what do you think, Jack? The emotional Biden versus the quick calculator Romney.
Well,
Ryan there.
Yeah, Biden is facing a severe headwind. A recent Pew poll showed him upside down in favorability, 10 points more unfavorable than favorable.
Joe Biden? Interesting.
Joe Biden, yes. And a focus group I watched last week conducted it about 2 weeks ago in Virginia. People were asked, what's your one word? These are swing voters. What's your one word for Joe Biden? The words joke. Idiot, incompetent, good. Well, he did get a good. And that is what Pew found, too, that people tend to think of him as a buffoon. That was one of the words that people associated with him in that poll. He is a liability for the Obama campaign. And if you don't think they're worried, oh boy.
Supposed to be the steady guy 4 years ago, the steady guy at the elbow. Here was a recorded message. This was released Wednesday night. Vice President Joe Biden praising President Obama's debate performance.
If you just finished watching the debate like I did, I'm sure you're as proud of President Obama as I am. I've been saying for a long time, this election presents the starkest choice in my memory, and I think the president did a wonderful job in making it clear just how stark that choice is.
Well, a wonderful job. That's why presidents have vice presidents. Richard in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Richard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom and panel. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have the thing with Mitt Romney after the debate. I have to say I'm willing to give him a second look, and I'll say why. But okay. I do have some concerns I'd like to throw out to you in the panel.
Yes,
one is, so we know he was a moderate governor in Massachusetts and clearly got a lot done in a democratically majority state and a democratically controlled legislature. So what Mitt Romney will we get? Which Mitt Romney will we get in the White House? And will he be able to prevail over the conservative elements of his own party in the House of Representatives and perhaps the Senate? That's my biggest concern about him, is who will we get, and will he have enough of a backbone to actually be a moderate amidst a pretty strong wave of conservatism in his own party?
Richard, those are really good questions, and I appreciate them coming in there from Iowa. Let me bring it to everybody. I mean, Jack, I'll bring it first to you, because you and I were both in Massachusetts when Mitt Romney was the governor. He did work with the Democrats, as he pointed out the other night, in a debate on historic health care reform here. It is pretty much the model for what Obama did nationally. But many have said that was kind of the exception in terms of bipartisan outreach. And I mean, I will just speak frankly here in saying Mitt Romney is famously a little hard to know. Even though I was here when he was governor, it was hard to know what the real bottom line. So what about Richard's question? If he should go to the White House, do we see a moderate? Do we see a prisoner of hard right Republicans? What do you think, Jack?
Well, I think the idea that the Romney campaign would like to encourage is that you see an eminently pragmatic man who will do the possible, and that's the really what he learned in business. I mean, he approaches politics like business. You do what works. And he has never been troubled by ideological consistency or even consistency of particular views. He will do what works. And I think that's the view they wanted to get this moderate voters to get. But here's the problem. What works in Washington may be something very conservative indeed. And of course, he's locked into the most conservative position imaginable. $10 of spending cuts for $1 in tax increases, no deal, he says.
Well, locked into. What does that mean, Jack? I mean, remember Etch-a-Sketch. That was his advisor's words.
That's true.
This is if he's that pragmatic, you say what you need to there, but
that's right.
But what's he steering toward, Brian? What's his poll star our voter Richard in Iowa wants to know what's the guiding compass reading here.
Well, you know, again, I think Jack's right in that Mitt Romney is a pragmatist, and you know, he's as much a CEO as he likes to present himself, to get things done, to get the problem solved, to fix things, he's very operational in that sense. And so he'll, as president, I would certainly see him erring more to that side.
But
than,
get what done? You know, it kind of matters what you're deciding to do. And if you're a pragmatist, what do you do when a very strong wing of your party comes and sits down in the Oval Office and says, President Romney, we want the agenda that you promised in the Republican primary?
Well, that's actually probably the point that President Obama was making in the debates, although he didn't do it very well, that, you know, there's no specifics here. There's no details here. There's, you know, he talks about his plan for the economy, but it's fuzzy on the math. He talks about his plan for health care, but there, you know, he says he likes what they did in Massachusetts, but doesn't like Obamacare. So what would you do, President Romney? There's not a lot of specifics there. And that's the label that the Democrats are trying to tarnish him with. And I think for the American public, that's the decision they're going to have to make if there's enough there to work with to select him as president, or if it's just too ambiguous.
Molly Ball, is that just a tarnishing attack by political opponents, or given Mr. Romney's different positions over time, does our caller in Iowa have a fair question there? And how would you answer him about what to expect of a President Romney, if that's what it would be?
Well, yeah, it's absolutely a fair point, and it is something that we're going to hear the Democrats hammering home, the old flip-flopper argument, which, of course, has been a problem for Romney for many years now. But look, I think voters are part of the reason voters are so turned off to Washington is this idea of gridlock, this idea that they can't get anything done, they can't come together, they can't compromise. The president has an enormous bully pulpit, especially within his own party. You didn't see a lot of the conservative criticisms of George Bush coming out, for example, until the very end of his term and when he was out of office, even though there was a lot of dissatisfaction there, especially with the spending. A lot of Romney's critique of Obama here is not about ideology. It's about leadership and it's about competence. And so he's saying, you know, I am an executive. I'm somebody who gets things done. I am somebody who would make things happen in Washington. There's pretty much a 0% chance that we won't continue to have divided government in Washington, because no matter who takes the Senate, nobody's going to have 60 votes. And so, and people feel like that's something that President Obama has failed to do, and instead has turned to blaming Republicans for his own or for Washington's inability to get things done. On the other hand, I mean, you mentioned Romney's history in Massachusetts, and one of the reputations he had there was that he was sort of aloof, and that he wasn't very good at schmoozing the legislators and getting people to come together, with the exception of health care. So I think that's also a legitimate question of whether he can back up this argument he's making.
Jack, I'm still channeling Richard in Iowa and thinking, you know, I'm just not so sure. I mean, Brian and Molly are kind of, and you are kind of taking this pragmatist depiction. But we all saw 2010, the Tea Party, those very, very stern, determined Congress people who came in, they haven't gone away, and they're not unserious about their goals for this government and right on down the line. Is Mitt Romney really going to just, you know, say, oh, boys, come on, you know, celebrate the victory and let's just sort of split the difference and off we go? Really?
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? I mean, what has been his practice? His practice in Massachusetts was he had a liberal Democratic legislature. He created, since the New Deal, really, the biggest experiment in health insurance since then. Now he's going to go to Washington and have the most conservative Republican Congress in decades, and he's going to have to work with them and what they want. You know, I think he's in line with them. He's embraced pretty much the Ryan budget, drastic cuts in domestic spending. He wants to have this big tax cut or tax reform program, whatever you want to call it. He wants to get tough with China. All of those things seem to be in line with at least some of the impulses of the Tea Party. So the environment to which he adapts himself may well be congruent with something inside Mitt.
Let's go to Carl in Nashville. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Listen, I fundamentally disagree with your guest a minute ago when she said that Obama should take responsibility for the gridlock in Washington, because absolutely the night that he was inaugurated, the Republicans sat down and hatched a plan to be obstructionist. And I absolutely fundamentally disagree with Brian earlier when he said, well, we always knew that Mitt Romney wasn't a severe conservative, and now he's playing the moderate governor. So either he lied then or he's lying now. Either way, he's lying. And the American public will give a politician some leeway, but I don't think we would fundamentally elect a liar. And if you want an October surprise, 7%. There you go.
7% unemployment. Hey, but Carl, let me ask you, because there's the president and the Republicans are saying, yes, you got gridlock in his first term and you will have it in the second term. And as a country, we can't afford that. What's the president's answer to that? If he wasn't able to sort of out-psych, outmaneuver Republicans first term, how would he lead us out of gridlock in the second term, Carl?
Then it's not up to the president. It is up to the American people to be smart enough to not believe the spin coming from, I hate to say it, your guests blaming it on Obama when the Republicans had meetings the night of the inauguration. This man hadn't even put forth policy. The night of the inauguration, they said that we will do everything to obstruct them. And it's up for us to understand that and push through and vote people out of office.
Carl, we've got the point. Let me take it to Brian Monroe. Carl, it's not up to the president in a second term, or in maybe ever, if there's that attitude across the aisle. But I'm not so sure about that. The president, after all, the buck stops there. Isn't he the guy who's got to change the chemistry, or is Carl right?
He is, and you know, the point that Carl makes, I'll come back and just reiterate, this is politics. These guys, in whether it's in the White House or in Congress, Republicans, Democrats, fight and want to win. And yes, did the Republicans get together in 2009 and hatch a not-so-secret plan to stop Obama at every turn and make him a one-term president? There's no question about that. But that's how the game is played, fortunately or unfortunately, in this town. And so the president has to bring his, if he wants to fight against that, he has to bring the power of his bully pulpit hard at them. You know, one thing that's interesting, the 60-vote threshold for the Senate to break a filibuster was a real deal. He only had that up until Ted Kennedy died, and Scott Brown filled that seat, and he lost it. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that, Harry Reid, at the beginning of this next the Congress that took over that's currently sitting, Harry Reid could have changed those rules. Mm-hmm. On the first day of the Senate, there was one vote that only needed a simple majority to change the filibuster rules. Mm-hmm. He chose not to. I think history is going to look back and say that was a missed opportunity, because what happened after that were record filibusters.
He didn't? Was he afraid that the shoe would be on the other foot and he would want that filibuster power for his own party?
I think some of it was indeed that he was concerned about the precedent that it would set to change a fundamental Senate rule. Remember, the Senate runs under their own rules and they can make and break them at any time. But to change a fundamental rule like that, he was like, oh, my goodness, that may come back to bite me or further Democrat or Republican Senates, and was hesitant to do that. But that was a window where the Democrats, if they wanted to play as hard a politics as the Republicans were already playing, could have changed the rules.
Molly, what do you say to Carl in Nashville? You journalists are too quick to buy the sort of Republican interpretation here.
Well, I'm just reflecting, you know, what I've heard from voters and what they're saying in polls. But there's a really good point there, which is the American people do blame both parties. The American people do not just blame Obama for the gridlock in Washington. And in fact, in a lot of the polls I've seen, they blame Republicans more and they blame congressional Republicans more. And in fact, part of the reason that Obama's not doing worse is that people still blame George Bush more for the economic problems than they blame Obama.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, La Crosse, Wisconsin, TV anchorwoman Jennifer Livingston made headlines when she went after a viewer who had chided her for being overweight.
He doesn't see that the way that he approached it was clearly hurtful to me. He's trying to shame me into losing weight. That's not being helpful. That's being a bully.
Not helpful. An outbreak of rare fungal meningitis, more than 30 cases in 6 states affecting back pain patients who received spinal steroid injections. At least 5 deaths already. Here's 81-year-old Richard Jenkins in Nashville.
They called after the third injection, but it was a good while. They called and just wanted to know how I was doing. They didn't say anything about the meningitis outbreak or anything like that.
Boy, good luck, Mr. Jenkins. And British singing sensation Adele is out with her new theme song for the next James Bond film, Skyfall. It was leaked earlier this week, then officially released last night at 007 Greenwich Mean Time. We're looking at a week in the news. We've got a little more political conversation here, and then want to also look at Turkey, Syria, what's going on with airliner seats, the consulate in Benghazi, and whether or not it was left unprotected, the 7.8% unemployment numbers that have come in, with Brian Monroe of CNNPolitics.com, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's get a couple more on politics. Judy in Arlington, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Judy.
Hi, I'm really sorry to bring it back to this. I'm sure you're sick of talking about
it. No, we're not. Here we are. Home stretch. What do you say?
Yes. Okay, I have a couple of comments and then a question. My feeling from watching politics for the past 40 years is Democrats are terribly lousy at playing politics, the kind of politics that has come up, especially since Reagan was president. This is reminding me of Reagan at a debate. There's so much flash, so much glitz, so much superficial. Look at this handsome man. But behind it, there is nothing. And that's what the Republican strategists are geniuses at this, and the Democratic strategists are lousy at this.
Does that make it okay for President Obama, not a bad-looking man himself, to look down at his notes and purse his lips?
This is my feeling. I wish that some Republican strategists would see the light, come over, and say this. Now, they may have done this, and that they don't listen. That's a real possibility. I'm not in the loop.
Yeah.
But that's one thing I feel. I also feel like the debate view was very male versus female, because it's presented almost like a war and a battle. You know, who won? And my first friend told me, because I won't watch those things, but I read it and I listen to it, is Romney was a bully. And that's the first thing I heard, and I heard a couple other side comments like that. And it's a very male view, like who won this fight. So anyway, that's just my comment. But I wanted to ask the question, because this
okay.
debate is solely targeted to the undecideds, okay? And it's to fire up the Republican base, especially, to get them out to convince the undecideds. What's the story? How many undecideds are there in America, in the swing states, who are deciding our election?
Let's take the question right there. I mean, everybody's deciding in a way, because those big bases wouldn't be there if all those Republicans and Democrats who have decided, if they hadn't, they wouldn't be there. But what about it, Brian? How big a swing is out there?
We just did a piece on this on CNNPolitics.com where we looked at what we call the slivers of undecided voters. And there aren't that many of them left. There are, depending on, in poll, it's real hard to nail this down with polling, but depending on who you listen to, somewhere between 3% and 8% of the electorate can fall in that category of undecided.
Well, that's plenty to decide something like this.
But here's a little comparison. Mm-hmm. If you rewind back, during the Clinton years or when George Herbert Walker Bush was running, or even before that, there was roughly about 40% on one side, about 40% on the other, and about 20% in the middle, depending on how close you were to the election, that were malleable, that were leaning one way or leaning the other way or undecided, and you could make a case there. That 20% in the middle is now down to 3 or 4%. And that is partly because both campaigns and both parties have gotten really, really good at getting everyone over to their sides. At this point, 32 days before the election, not a lot of people don't have an opinion right now. They've already made a decision. And in fact, by Election Day, 40% of the country will have already had the opportunity to vote. And so, they will have not just decided, but taken action on that decision.
Hey, Molly, so what about...
They've gotten good at this.
Yeah, we get that, but do you see, are there any poll findings yet, Brian, about whether something has changed essentially here? Is it really up in the air? Maybe Judy doesn't even want to hear that kind of language, but after all, somebody will win on November 6th.
Well, it's even more narrow in the what we call the nine battleground states, or now, it may be even more narrow there, that there aren't a lot of folks who haven't made up their minds already, but that is where you're seeing the campaign spending the millions and billions of dollars trying on TV ads and direct mail and having people, if you live in, say, California, and you've pretty much already made up your mind who you're going to vote for, they're putting you on a bus and busing you to Nevada to make make the case there, which is a swing state. They're spending a lot of time and effort trying to get these small slivers of voters.
Molly, is, you know, it's just a sliver of undecideds, so is the outcome still quite, you know, very much up in the air? And what about our caller, Julie's sort of, I don't like this, you know, boys bashing boys. Do you see a gender character to what was going on there Wednesday?
Well, Romney was very aggressive, and one thing that was very interesting was that the sort of snap polling post-debate did find that voters overwhelmingly thought Romney won the debate, and they overwhelmingly liked him better on the issues after the debate. However, his personal favorability numbers, and Obama's as well, did not move. So he didn't do the sort of warm and fuzzy thing. He didn't make people like him any better as a person. On Brian's point, I mean, it is, there's no doubt we've become a more polarized, more ideological country. The parties are more ideologically aligned now than they've ever been. You no longer have a big block of sort of yellow dog Democrats in the South or liberal Republicans in the Northeast. But I think it's also true that when we say there's only a few percent of undecideds, those polls generally are pushing leaners. So they're asking people, first, who do you support? And then they're saying, well, who do you lean toward? And they're counting those in each candidate's total. So there are still voters who are actually persuadable, even if they are telling pollsters that they lean toward one candidate or another, because what the poll wants to find is what would happen if the election were held today. But a lot of those people still could be persuaded, and they are being pelted with all of these ads in the swing states. And especially after the debate, you know, they may have a more open mind toward both candidates.
Chris, in Orlando, Florida. Chris, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a teacher's assistant here at a local university in economics, and I'd like to kind of bring you to ground zero, kind of get through the fluff of, you know, who's better looking, who's more more hip and the whatnot. But basically, the unemployment rate, they say, is 8%. I'm going to say it's more in the range of 11 to 12%. Foreclosures are consistently high. The housing market still has not recovered. Gasoline is up 110%. Food is up 35%. And drilling, again, we're still constantly dependent on the Middle East. These are the issues that need to be addressed, not the fluff of who is Mr. Wonka or who is Mr. Fuzzy or who's bullying who. And I just don't get why the Democrats cannot seem to attack what is the true nature of the most important issues in this country. And these are the issues. And I'm talking about ground zero.
So who do you think did better on the issues Wednesday night, Chris?
Well, the issues, I would have to go with Romney. I mean, one of the things that really broke me up was when, unfortunately, Barack Obama did say that there have been more lands that have been open to drilling. And, again, you'd really have to be in the know and have your ear to the pavement. That was not a true statement. What is true is the drilling permits are down roughly 40% on public lands. They are up on private land.
Yeah, well, I mean, he said on land, so, I mean, you call it public, you call it private. But I take your point. There's a lot of hair splitting, and you go with Romney on the issues. I mean, it is... We do need to point out that technically, formally, unemployment is down to 7.8% now. And, of course, I know there are discouraged out there. Still, within that realm, many are welcoming that number down. I mean, Jack, what about on the issues? Did you see one more serious than the other on Wednesday night? One more honest?
Well, honest, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder. There have been several substantial pieces pointing to inaccuracies in things that both candidates have said, more on the Romney side.
You mentioned pre-existing condition coverage.
Yes,
insisting that he would cover that, but, of course, only for people who had continuous coverage, not for those who didn't have coverage.
That's right.
That's a pretty big distinction.
Pretty big distinction involving millions and millions of people. Another one was deducting... If you move a business overseas, you can't claim a deduction, he claimed. Well, you can, according to the New York Times, according to Fox News.
And President Obama saying, after how could he not know that? On the other hand, everybody's got their stuff. I mean, President Obama talks about a $4 trillion cut in the deficit, which includes getting out of Afghanistan and Iraq, which of you got to kind of assume we would do that in any case.
That's right.
You'd like to hope so anyway.
That's right. Funny numbers. I thought that to me, the strongest moment in the debate was just when Romney cited the facts. Of course, now he doesn't have the 8% unemployment to go on, but he just talked about how profoundly this recession has damaged the hopes, the lives of the American middle class. He just put it in one sentence, and that's unanswerable. There's no question about that. The question is, did the president do enough to prevent that? And, of course, they have strong arguments. We did everything we could. But then Romney came back with a very strong argument. Did you really? How did you spend 2 years trying to go after Obamacare when you should have been worried about jobs? That's a very effective argument, I think. And I can imagine, having watched this focus group in Leesburg, Virginia, a couple of weeks ago of undecided voters, that's just the kind of argument that I think would appeal to them. They didn't get why Obama was doing Obamacare when the economy was in this parlous condition.
Well, I mean, effective rhetorically, and yes, you can make the argument. On the other hand, there was a lot of big stimulus work during that time. The Republicans mm-hmm. were up in arms about because it was too much. Matt in Omaha, Nebraska. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, I just wanted to make a real quick point, mm-hmm. and then I'll get off here. I really think that the average American, with the massive amount of media that they see every day concerning these two politicians, yeah. I think that this debate is going to be a moot point by the time it comes in November. I think that they're going to have no recollection of it, and they have two more debates to go through. And I just think that what they saw the other night, the average American won't at all recall.
Two more to go. Of course, it depends what those two are like. If they're just like the first one, they may recall the whole succession. But point taken, Matt. One more, George in Brockton, Massachusetts. George, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
All right. So here's my thing. I have to reflect the views of the last caller about the average American. The economic numbers and the economic feelings of people in the country are not the same. They speak differently to us than to the political pundits. Those who are going to vote Romney are going to vote Romney anyway. Those who are going to vote Obama will not change their mind because of this one debate.
Do you think the economy's headed up or down, George? Which way? What's your gut?
It's absolutely headed up, and people are feeling that. Everybody I talk to, for the most part, believe it's going to head up.
So there's some optimism, the kind of optimism that should help the Obama camp. George, I appreciate your call. Jack, you know, we've barely touched abroad, and there was this really interesting development this week where we saw artillery shells flying back and forth between Syria, which has been locked in this terrible, bloody, and now quite long civil war, and Turkey, NATO ally, which means that we have an obligation to its defense. NATO making some sort of tough sounds here. Nobody expecting this to, I don't know, spill over the borders and turn into something regional with NATO involved. But this was the first time we saw that literal trading of shells across the border.
Well, indeed, and in an unprecedented step, last night the Security Council condemned the Syrian mortar attack, including Russia. They softened the resolution, but Russia voted for it. So that's a straw of some sort in the wind. But meanwhile, look at the retaliation Turkey has had. Nearly 12 hours of artillery attacks aimed at a Syrian forward base. According to rebel sources, 14 Syrian soldiers killed. And the Turkish prime minister went to his parliament and secured a one-year mandate to send troops into a foreign country if he has to. Now, they say, well, this doesn't mean war, but it certainly sounds like, you know, to the opposition in Turkey, they're calling it a war bill. So, yes, this is really heating up with this international dimension. And meanwhile, of course, the refugee flows are continuing to surge into all the surrounding countries, and the Turks want a buffer zone around that border where refugees could go. The United States says no, it would be too risky to do that because you'd have to knock out Syrian air defenses, and that would be too risky. So that's where we are.
On the other side of the Suez, back in Libya, I mean, that has not gone away yet, and this week a lot of complaining about what protection was there and not there for the consulate in Benghazi, where four died, including the U.S. ambassador. Brian Monroe, does that have political legs here at home?
Well, it has been simmering, and I expect it certainly to come up during the debate. I think it's the third one where they're focusing on international issues. But one thing interesting that we just saw, that the FBI finally got into Benghazi after, what, 3 weeks?
In and out. They didn't stay. It was too dangerous, I guess, for them to get in there. They had U.S. military cover.
They went in, got whatever evidence that was left that hadn't been already picked up by others, and then got out. And that, you know, has people scratching their heads why it took so long, and what kind of investigation could they do in, what, a day or so?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't think this issue is dead or over yet.
Molly, there's been talk of a Mitt Romney foreign policy speech any day now. Is that still on the books, or does he just want to sort of ride the moment out of Denver and not change the focus?
No, it's actually been scheduled. He's doing it Monday morning at the Virginia Military Institute. There are a lot of really serious questions about the way the administration has handled this situation.
You mean Benghazi?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Obama's edge on foreign policy, I think, has largely come from this impression that he tamped down the chaos of the Bush years, put out the fires across the globe, killed bin Laden, got us out of Iraq. If people get the impression now that the world is becoming more dangerous, a terrorist attack on 9/11, that the administration sort of failed to take seriously or characterize correctly, Romney has not done a good job handling foreign policy thus far, but he's going to try and turn it around with this speech in Virginia on Monday.
Well, we'll try and keep a sense of scale here. New York Times reporting this week that there is planning, tracking anyway, for potential retaliation against the attackers in Benghazi. So we could have the crackle of gunfire into this campaign before it's over. I want to thank each of you for being with us today. Just terrific to have you. Molly Ball with The Atlantic joining us from Denver, where she was at the debates. Molly, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Tom.
Brian Monroe, editor of CNNpolitics.com, always terrific, out of Washington, D.C. today. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom, and Molly, and Jack. Always a pleasure.
You bet. And Jack, great to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.